you know, it really wasn't about what he said, but about how he said it.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. Returning to the roundup this week is Liam Donovan. Liam has nearly two decades of experience working at the intersection of politics and policy. He's currently a principal at Bracewell LLP and spent two election cycles at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, where we met and worked together. He's also the host of a great podcast called The Lobby Shop. Liam, welcome back.
Thanks, Ron. Good to be here.
Also returning is Alex Thompson, Axios' national political correspondent covering the 2024 election, who's previously a White House correspondent for Politico, where he created their daily West Wing playbook. Alex, great to see you again.
Great to be here.
Up first this week, we're going to break down Biden's State of the Union address and how the content and delivery could shape the election cycle. Then we will read the tea leaves in the Super Tuesday results, Nikki Haley bowing out of the race and Donald Trump's move to purify the Republican Party. And we'll find out what other political developments our panel are paying attention to and why. Finally, for our Politicology Plus members, we're going to discuss Katie Porter's cries of election rigging in the California Senate primary. If you're not yet one of our amazing Politicology Plus members and you want to hear more from our brilliant guests, politicology.com/plus is how you can get access to everything we publish, and it's all ad-free, and you'll be joining a thoughtful group of pro-democracy listeners who help keep this show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus, or just click the link right in your show notes. The stakes were incredibly high for Joe Biden going into Thursday night at the Capitol when he gave his State of the Union address, even though expectations may have been very low, thanks to Trump and Republicans focusing incessantly on his old age, as well as many Democrats whispering their concerns. With the nominations now locked in, we'll get to Super Tuesday later, this speech kicks off the 2024 campaign in earnest. And in addition to all the usual objectives of the State of the Union, Biden also had to alleviate concerns about his age and fitness. CBS News described the speech as defiant. The Atlantic said it was the most unusual State of the Union in living memory. And even Republican Congressman Ryan Zinke told USA Today he was impressed by Biden's energy. During the speech, Republican commentators like former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer retired the Sleepy Joe nickname and accused Biden of being too amped up. Without ever mentioning Trump by name, Biden referenced his predecessor 13 times. He went off script multiple times, jousting with Republicans and riffing on taxes, Social Security, and the border. And we put together a quick montage of highlights from last night so that you can catch up quick. Go ahead and roll that.
My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. Too many corporations raise prices to pad their profits, charging more and more for less and less. That's why we're cracking down on corporations that engage in price gouging and deceptive pricing, from food to healthcare to housing. In fact, the snack companies think you won't notice if they change the size of the bag and put a hell of a lot fewer, same size bag. Put fewer chips in it. No, I'm not joking. It's called shrinkflation. Pass Bobby Casey's bill and stop this. Not really. Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. I know it may not look like it, but I've been around a while. Above all, I see a future for all Americans. I see a country for all Americans. And I will always be president for all Americans because I believe in America. I believe in you, the American people. You're the reason we've never been more optimistic about our future than I am now. So let's build the future together. Let's remember who we are. We are the United States of America. And there is nothing, nothing beyond our capacity when we act together. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
All right, let's just start with initial reactions to the speech at as a whole. I won't lead any witnesses here. Liam, why don't you kick off?
Yeah, I think he met the moment, right? I mean, as you mentioned, I think reality set in this week with the conclusion of September or of Super Tuesday. You had the main challengers bow out and acknowledge reality. This is going to be the matchup. And so I think all the hand-wringing among Democrats of, is this guy up to the job? Are we going to have to replace him? Those sorts of things really came home here. He needed to step up under the bright lights and deliver a speech that would quiet those murmurs. And I think he did it. I think the benefit of having the rough stretch that he's had really as far back as I can remember is the bar's low. And, he came out with energy. He had some humor. He riffed a bit. He had stumbles, but that's baked into who he is, right? So I think, he accomplished what he sought to do, which was really kind of comfort an anxious, I think chatterati in a lot of ways. He got himself some good headlines in swing states, good headlines in national media. And I can think of the last time that actually happened. So I don't think this is enduring. These are not speeches that last. But I think if Democrats get this Biden on a consistent basis, they'll feel much better going forward.
Yeah. Alex, what do you think?
I know it's not good podcasting to just agree, but I think Liam is right. I would add that, it really wasn't about what he said, but about how he said it. And honestly, he could have been reading the dictionary or Ulysses, but if he read it that way, the reaction would have been the same from Democrats. It was a very partisan speech. I don't think this was not a speech designed to try to win over Republicans, with maybe the exception of sort of a triangulation on immigration. This was a speech about rallying his base with Liam's point, to quiet these murmurs that have just been growing louder and louder and louder. It's a State of the Union speech. All it takes is for him to have a senior moment or him fall again. And then all of that will come back up. But for now, I think he did himself a ton of favors for at least several weeks, not longer, at putting some of those concerns at bay.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the delivery was probably the best part of the speech. We should definitely get into some of the content here. There's a lot to say about it. But specifically on the AIDS front, this is not something that the White House was even willing to go near a year ago. And we've talked about on the show how, the best tack for him on something like immigration, where he was losing so badly, was to face it head on and lean into it and actually lead. And that actually the same approach could work for him on the age concerns. And it looks like he actually did that. Not only mentioned his age, he made a joke about it, which is a big switch in their strategy. So I wonder, Liam, if you think we'll see more of that as this goes on, or if the White House is maybe hoping this was just a reset. Let's not talk about age anymore, and put everybody's fears at bay. And now he's just going to disappear for a long time.
I think it has to be baked into all of these speeches, these opportunities. I think there are ways he got at it in self-deprecating ways, which I think can work. I mean, Reagan showed that can be a powerful tool. He baked it into the prepared remarks where he's talking about, I've been called too young, when he was, a 29-year-old senator-elect. He's been called too old. I think you have to acknowledge it because everyone understands it. Everybody gets it. And so you have to acknowledge the elephant in the room. I don't think you dwell on it necessarily, but I think you parry it with humor. You take it head on, as you said, and you have to be willing to address it. If you try to cocoon him, hide him away in a basement, pretend that there aren't concerns around this, you're playing with fire. And so I think they acknowledge that reality here in the speech.
There was also a lot of my predecessor and referencing your political opponent, Alex, who's also your predecessor at the same time, so frequently is unusual. It's also especially unusual for an election year State of the Union. How do you think his framing sort of making the election look more like a choice rather than a referendum came across. This is what the White House has been trying to do for a long time. How do you think that came across in the speech?
It was interesting. I feel like the fact that he didn't say Trump's name was basically just him sort of being, you know, at least respecting a tradition of the State of the Union. You know, he's sort of old school, but even though it was a campaign speech in all but name. And you've seen this, you know, Biden very deliberately, beginning in his first year, they made a conscious decision to basically never say Trump's name. And that shifted abruptly, basically starting in November, when they saw all these polls, and they have been set about trying to make this more and more of a referendum. Now, you know, I think part of the hangup, as with a lot of these things, is that you know, just because it's good strategy doesn't mean you have the buy-in of the principle, and that includes the age thing. So I think, you know, Biden, I think, has a real distaste for even like saying his name, that he had to actually like literally get over, that, and now he's like fully bought in. And the same thing on the age, you know, I can tell you like behind closed doors, part of the problem with getting him to confront the age thing was that, you know, Biden is a bit defensive about it and often says to aides that, you know, he constantly is saying, you know, I feel so much younger than my age. I feel so much younger than my age. And, you know, I think he had to get over a little bit of the age denialism. His aides had to convince him of it in order to address it. It's, you know, the aides around him are experienced, political operatives. They know the numbers were bad. I think the shift that you've seen is they finally got the principal on board.
Republicans can't decide on Sleepy Joe or Speedy Joe.
What Alex was saying reminds me.
Ahead,
they had the big viral Jon Stewart comeback Daily Show segment that was echoed in an SNL cold open, I think, where, you know, that's the joke is everybody says, well, you know, you should see him behind closed doors and he's, you know, he's energetic and he's whatever. And you know, Stewart's there like begging people like, okay, if that's the case, like show us. And so I think that seems to be that they realize they finally do have to show, not tell.
Yeah. Yeah. Alex, our team saw that you were tracking Democrats reacting to Biden's use of the term illegal in that clip that we just played. And the backstory there we should mention is that as he's walking up the aisle, Marjorie Taylor Greene gives him a pin and he takes the pin and it has Lachlan Riley's name on it. Lachlan Riley is the woman who was killed in Georgia by an illegal immigrant recently, caused an uproar. We talked about it in the podcast. And she interrupts him at one point when he's talking about border security and her shirt says, say her name. Can you describe that moment and how it's being talked about, particularly among progressive Democrats? Because we can't really know if it was a plant or a slip, but what impact do you think it could have on, you know, the perception that Biden is beholden to and controlled by the furthest left flank of his party, especially on border security?
So a few things about what happened. So, you know, the initial reaction I heard from Democrats was, you know, there was sort of relief that he was able to handle the heckling and sort of ad lib. And, you know, the fact that he brought the pin up and did say her name, although he said Lincoln instead of Lakin. But I think there was some of that. But then what happened was, you know, it used to be very common, on both sides of the aisle to just refer to undocumented immigrants as illegal immigrants or an illegal, using it as a noun. And, you know, Joe Biden used to be part of that. If you go back through the clips of Joe Biden on immigration,
oh yeah,
in the 90s and 2000s, he was on the hawkish side of this issue. And the Democratic Party has changed significantly. And the fact that my guess is that this is just like one of those classic sort of like old guy slips where when he's ad-libbing, he goes back to sort of the lingo he's used to using. But that, you know, and Nancy Pelosi even, you know, chided him a bit on CNN afterward and said he should have said undocumented. And then, you know, a bunch of the members of the Progressive Caucus felt that it was echoing Trump's language and, you know, othering or trying to dehumanize the people coming across the border. Now, I think this is going to end up being sort of a, you know, a tempest in a teacup here. I think people will get Democrats were so thrilled that with the performance, mostly that they'll be like, we'll get over him using the word. So that's what I would say about that particular interaction.
Liam, I want to dive into some of the substance of the speech, because there was a lot here. And indeed, there was a lot of Obama, 2013 era stuff in here. But I wonder if you want to just walk through some of the substance that stood out to you. And if you don't cover it, I've got some things to say about shrinkflation. But why don't you lead off?
If you told me, you know, before the speech, what was in it and what he touched on, I wouldn't have been surprised. But I did think that the way they structured it, what they chose to prioritize, was quite interesting. Obviously, the framing was immediately Ukraine, right? That was what they came out of the gate with. And that's an interesting choice. I mean, number one, it's the one of the few instances in the speech where it seemed to be using the bully pulpit to try to accomplish something in the here and now rather than speaking to an electoral audience, because Ukraine's not going to be the deciding factor in this election, but it is the one thing that's before Congress right now, and he has some potential power to effectuate. And there's a ticking clock on that, obviously. It's obviously something that he's passionate about and something that he sees as part of his legacy as the guy who was previously, you know, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that kind of thing. So I think setting the tone for a passionate speech, you want to lead with something that he cares a lot about, and that came through in the speech. He moves from Ukraine into January 6th. So the defense of democracy broadly, obviously that was the reason he got into the race in 2020 in the first place. You know, it's something that he comes back to regularly. It's something that animates the Democratic coalition in a major way. Next, he goes to IVF and talks about Roe and Dobbs. Those make sense. I mean, you're going from something that's like, you know, trying to speak to Congress and then going over them to speak to the American people and particularly the Democratic coalition, which is obviously in a tense moment here. He gets later in the speech and starts getting into, you know, I think the more interesting things to me, which was the populist tones, the things that you mentioned along the lines of Obama 2013. If he's going to put the blue wall Rust Belt states back together, and it looks like he has to, because it's not looking great in Georgia, it's not looking so good in Arizona, his path to victory is going to be winning places like Michigan, places like Pennsylvania, places like Wisconsin. You notice in the first lady's box, you know, the people that he shouted out, a lot of those states mentioned. And I think those themes that he was getting at, the sort of blue collar sensibilities, talking about walking the picket line with Sean Fain, talking about how corporations aren't paying their fair share, talking about how we're going to stick it to the wealthy. Those aren't new themes, but I think they're things that, you know, tend to get left behind as the coalition of Democrat voters has shifted toward a more affluent sensibility. And so getting back to that roots of like Lunch Bucket Joe, I think was notable to me and something that I'm going to keep watching for as the election continues. But I think it gets into a much more of a laundry list where he's like box checking of like, send me the PRO Act. So, you know, pass the John Lewis Voting Rights, whatever act. And there's a lot of coalition management that got on, but it's very clear the key themes that he wanted to hit here. I think the other one that I would mention is kind of backloading Israel and Gaza, and a pretty significant announcement. If there was news in this, I think the temporary peer was probably the biggest, but he's very careful about it, probably because, you know, that's probably the biggest point of contention within the Democratic coalition right now, is that they're not doing enough or not doing, you know, not emphasizing the humanitarian aspects enough. So the choice to make big news but kind of bury the lead, I think, was notable to me. But those are sort of the key things that stood out to me.
Yeah, I want to talk about the economic populism embedded in this speech, and I'm just curious about whether both of you think this is a sort of winning political approach, and or whether it's where the most of the Democratic Party is, because he ad-libs about snack food companies decreasing the number of, you know, chips in a bag, the number of Snickers in the, you know, the same size package. But, you know, calling this, as they have, shrinkflation or greedflation or whatever you want, price gouging or, you know, corporate greed, it all boils down to the same thing, which is inflation, which is what they're trying to run away from. And as Milton Friedman famously explained, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Something I think people are forgetting here is the way the money supply has vastly expanded over the last several years. And you know, between March of 2020, March of 2022, the number of dollars circulating in the economy exploded by a factor of 5. So let me say this a different way. In March of 2022, 80% of all the dollars in existence had been created in the previous 2 years. So you have all this money sloshing around. We got massive inflation. Everybody knows this. Demand goes up, prices go up, everything goes up, and your money doesn't buy as much as it did before. And now he's blaming candy bar makers for having to deal with the consequences of inflation, which is you either raise prices or you put fewer products in the bag. And this, like, you know, price gouging or corporate greed, just for me as a seeker of truth, as a lover of facts and numbers, doesn't add up, but it's super popular and you heard people cheering. So I wonder if, you know, if this return to economic populism, this rhetoric is going to be effective, even though I think it's so dishonest, frankly.
I think their messaging on inflation has been muddled for a long time now. And that's partly, I think, because they are so defensive about it. You know, it, at the same time, yes, they are talking about shrinkflation. And there were other efforts, you know, with especially when Ron Klain was there, who really pushed this internally, where they would, you know, bash gas companies for, you know, hiking prices and you know, they would do it every once in a while. But then at the same time, how do you reconcile with, like, you know, all the inflation is their fault? Well, at the same time, you are bragging about how inflation has come down. And you're bragging about how great the economy is. So it's, you know, they're trying to say two things at once, which basically is that we fixed it, and if you're mad about anything, it's someone else's fault. And you know, and this, I think, comes again, it's like one of those things that comes from the top, where I think Biden has been, you know, very defensive about this issue, in part because, you know, he and, like, the entire administration very widely mocked everyone who who said that inflation could be bad, and they kept insisting it was going to be transitory. So there's this weird tendency where they're trying to, you know, brag about what they've done on the economy, and then, but they're also adding this weird caveat where it's like, if you actually are upset about inflation, it's not our fault. It's you know, the people at Doritos factory. So I think it's just sort of, I don't think they've figured it out. I think you're increasingly seeing that they're trying to boast a little bit less about their economic success and try to talk more about their vision for the future, which also includes, like, picking your enemies. But it's been a little bit two steps forward, one step back.
Liam, do you think there is an effective way for them to talk about it, or is it better to just talk about something else? I mean, what we know about fiscal policy and monetary policy, that is very difficult to move public opinion on it with facts, because it has to do with how people are actually feeling day to day, whether or not that's, you know, consistent with what the economy and what the numbers actually show. So what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, their goal is to survive, parry, and pivot. I mean, this is not something they have a good answer for. It's not something they can necessarily control beyond what they've done. They have to hope for the best messages as best as possible. But to both your points, I think what they learned, and we've talked about this on the show in you know, previous months, where they found out the hard way that people don't want to be told that actually things are great and they're wrong. They don't want to be told that actually inflation is under control when people live a different reality. And so, you know, that there was some of that disconnect in the speech where I think they tried to thread the needle of saying, hey, we did all these good things. And, like, and the interesting part there was, and I think this is kind of a convention of State of the Union speeches, but, like, instead of saying, like, I did this, they said the State of the Union is strong, like, you did this. And there was, like, a way of trying to, like, build morale and say, hey, we're in good shape, but not trying to say I did anything. Everyone knows he's not going to get credit. Like, that's just not the mood that Americans right. are in. They're not going to say, you're right, you know, like, you did all this good stuff. But if you say, hey, you're the middle class, you're the heartbeat of this country, and you did this, and like, people might think, okay, yeah, maybe things are better than I was thinking. I think there's sort of a Jedi mind trick going on there, but there's no good answer to this issue. And as we've talked about in the past, like, it doesn't matter that it came down to 3% or whatever. It's baked in. It compounds right. over time.
It's baked so in. It's permanent.
It's ongoing. So if you've brought it right. down to normal levels, the past 2 years is baked into the baseline of what's growing. So like, that doesn't help you, except, you know, part of this is arming your side that is bummed out with a retort. So when they're around the kitchen table or around, you know, around the water cooler, you need to arm people who want to be with you with a reason why things aren't, you know, are actually the fault of somebody else, it would be worse under Trump. I mean, all these things are fodder for political arguments rather than anything that's truly going to satisfy people that are dissatisfied.
Let's talk about immigration. Liam, sorry, I can't help myself. During his victory speech on Tuesday, Trump claimed that the Biden administration was flying in hundreds of thousands of migrants from parts unknown, as he put it, arriving at airports and not going through borders, and that the Biden administration was keeping all of this secret. This was based on a report published by the Center for Immigration Studies. This is part of a program the Biden administration launched last January that would allow 30,000 people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to enter the country each month. People in the program have to apply online, have a financial sponsor, pay their own way, and then they arrive at a specified airport. Customs and Border Patrol also vets all of these applications. The program was also essential to a deal Biden struck with Mexico last spring to get Mexico to accept 30,000 people a month from the same countries in the wake of the Title 42 ending. So this wasn't really done in secret, but the government did not and still will not release the names of the 43 airports where these migrants were entering the country. And they cited some exemption of the Freedom of Information Act for law enforcement sensitive information. But it is now sort of going viral that the Biden administration is secretly flying in migrants to undisclosed ports of entry in the United States, airports that they won't disclose. What do you make of this? Do you think he did himself any favors with the way he handled the resistance to passing the immigration bill at the speech? And do you think we're going to get any resolution to this before the election, Liam?
Second question is easier. No, there's not going to be any kind of resolution. I mean, I think we watched the two-step, and we've talked about this on shows over time. It is it's a thorny issue. It's an issue that the people who profess to be most passionate about probably don't want to fix for a variety of reasons. And it's already been cast aside, even in the context of what it was purportedly going to fix, which is the broader standoff over national security funding in the Ukraine supplemental. So I don't see it resolving itself. I think to the extent that we've seen movement, it was the president indicating that he might seek executive action, which is actually where House Republicans have been demanding he go, for months at this point. I think back in December, they started saying this. Of course, they weren't satisfied with what he said he could do. They said, well, you said you couldn't do this. This just proves that you were not being truthful about it. In terms of how he handled the speech, you know, I think in a sense, Democrats probably are happy that they can blame Republicans for this. Whether the public agrees, I don't know that that's the case. And when you have the sorts of things that you mentioned, that sounds like it was ripped from like Breitbart or WorldNet Daily or some Alex Jones, thing. I've never heard that before. That sounds crazy, but it sounds like something that would definitely fuel the existing paranoia on the right about what they're doing here. But I think those are sort of audiences that are already primed to feel one way about these issues. The speech, I think, allows him to take the high ground and say he's looking for a solution, or Republicans aren't. I think the question is, what's the mood of the country? Are they looking for people to get things done, or are they just so ticked off that they want to, you know, turn the whole thing over and decide that, you know, their pre-COVID memories are fonder than what they've dealt with the last 3 years?
Let's turn to Super Tuesday. This week, Donald Trump won 14 of the 15 Republican primaries on Super Tuesday. Nikki Haley managed to win Vermont, but Trump swept the rest, including North Carolina, Virginia, Colorado. According to Semaphore, 62% of Haley voters in North Carolina and 76% of Haley voters in Virginia said they did not want to support the GOP nominee if their candidate lost. That doesn't mean they all won't vote for Trump in November, but at least they won't like it. In Virginia and North Carolina, about a third of Republican primary voters said they wouldn't vote for the GOP nominee regardless of who it was. 31% in Virginia, 34% in North Carolina. In North Carolina, two-thirds of Haley votes said Trump isn't physically or mentally fit to be president. Over 80% of Haley voters said they're not an automatic vote for the nominee. 53% of Haley voters in North Carolina said their vote was mostly against Trump. A Politico analysis found that Trump is struggling most in places where a majority of adults are college educated, including key suburbs that doomed his 2020 campaign. Haley bowed out of the race on Wednesday. She did not offer a traditional endorsement of Donald Trump. She did say that Trump would need to, quote, earn the votes of those in our party who did not support him, and that this, quote, is now his time for choosing, which JVL at the Bulwark seized upon, rightly so, and said this is the same man who in late January said that anyone who donated to Haley's campaign will be permanently banned from MAGA. Trump has spent the last couple of weeks trying to make it abundantly clear that he wants a smaller Republican Party with only people who are loyal to him. Here's Trump at a rally in Richmond.
And they say, always trying to demean, well, MAGA really represents 48% of the Republican Party. No, it represents 96% and maybe 100%. We're getting rid of the Romneys of the world. We want to get Romneys and those out.
Get Romneys and those out. Contrast that with the statement from Joe Biden, where he commended Haley for her courage in running for president. And here's the message Biden had for Haley supporters. Donald Trump made it clear he doesn't want Nikki Haley supporters. I want to be clear. There's a place for them in my campaign. I know there's a lot we won't agree on, but on the fundamental issues of preserving American democracy, on standing up for the rule of law, on treating each other with decency and dignity and respect, on preserving NATO and standing up to America's adversaries, I hope and believe we can find common ground. Alex, how do these numbers look for Trump, particularly in the context of the polling that's showing Trump with a lead, both in national polling and in most battleground states?
Well, I'd say the first thing about the polling that you referenced, you know, there's a reason why, with just one or two exceptions, Trump is almost never above 50% in any poll of this presidential race. He is usually stuck between 46, 48, and that's because, you know, his way of, you know, he is a base candidate, and he is not always an addition sort of politician. Now, we'll see if his team, you know, tries to change tact. You know, many consultants have tried to get Trump to be more magnanimous, and the half-life on that is usually less than a week. We'll see if that in any way changes. You know, the stuff about the Haley exit polls, my only caution is, I mean, it is unclear how many of those people voted for Trump in 2020 or 2016 anyway. You know, these are not necessarily people that have voted for Trump in the past. They very clearly could be sort of, you know, Mitt Romney, Romney Clinton voters, you know, people that are still sort of conservative, you know, so. Because it's very hard to reconcile how, in that New York Times poll that came out last Sunday, 97% of people that said they voted for Trump in 2020 are going to vote for him again. And with these exit polls that you're seeing with Nikki Haley. So those are the two main points that I'll see. I'll be curious, you know, in terms of Joe, you know, Biden is clearly trying, you know, his instinct is is to try to, he's not a base candidate. He's like the exact opposite, right? And so I'm not surprised that he reached out magnanimously to Nikki Haley, but then he also has his own problem on his left flank.
Liam, as for Haley's comments, what did you think about how she tried to thread that needle there? It's a weird, weird statement to me. That more importantly, what do you think Biden needs to do if he's going to have a chance at winning over, you know, enough of those Haley primary voters heading into the general?
I think Biden's fate, unfortunately, is held less by him and more about things like ballot access for RFK Jr. I mean, it really does come down to, as Alex said, Trump is going to get between 46 and 48% of the vote. If that's enough to win, Biden's toast. If it's not enough to win, or I think the difference between 2016 and 2020 is, I think 94% of the vote was between the two parties in 2016. That's why Trump was able to win in these places. Trump actually improved his vote share in the key states from 16 to 2020, and he lost because 98% of the vote went to the two parties. So it really comes down to who's on the ballot where, and in the 5, 6, 7 states that matter, is RFK Jr. not pulling, okay, it's not going to be 15%, it's not going to be double digits. If it's 5, that's enough. And if you look at who he appeals to, yeah, on paper, superficially, Republican voters, Trump voters like him, like what he's about, but they don't mind Trump. So it's not like he's going to peel much away. The danger is, if you're looking at that data, there are elements of the among independents and of even core Democratic votes that could be peeled off there in sufficient number to cause real problems for Biden. At the end of the day, the thing for Biden is these Haley voters, the ones who are, you know, actually cross-pressured and not just kind of delaying the inevitable, he got them last time. So it's not additive to him. He needs to keep them, not just win them over. If they say, because you mentioned that fitness question, right? Like, I think that's a danger. We look at that number. These same people disapprove of Biden and think he's unfit. So if the question is between two people you deem unfit, do you vote for one of them over the other? And that double hater number is what this all comes down to. And if you look at, I mean, the numbers can be sliced any number of ways, but I've seen a lot of, I mean, the New York Times polling, for instance, the most recent bit, I think you had people that dislike both of them went for Biden by, I want to say, 16 points in 2020, and they currently favor Trump. That's a huge swing among a group that has only grown over time. And that's the problem, is those are the Haley people. It's people that don't like either of them and will have to determine, you know, who the lesser of two evils are, or even if they have to choose. If they don't have to choose, why not park with RFK Jr.? You can wash your hands of the whole thing. That's 2016 redux. That's the danger for Biden.
Yeah, the reason we talk about those Haley voters so much, and you mentioned cross pressure, is because, as you say correctly, they went for Biden in 2020. But in 2020, we didn't have the border crisis that we have now, and the cross pressure these voters are going to be getting is on both abortion and immigration. It's going to be reproductive rights versus border security and order. And we didn't have that dynamic the way it currently is in 2020. And that's why the White House is now so insistent, like they're so desperate to get a deal on immigration, because they've got to take one of those things. They got to weaken one of those sources of cross pressure on that essential group of voters. Alex, do we know anything about No Labels yet, about what they're going to do with their ticket? I saw something recently that they plan to announce a formal process for selection, but that they are indeed going forward with the ticket. Do you have any insight there?
Yeah, I mean, we should know more actually right around when this podcast is posting. I mean, the problem that No Labels has now, besides the fact that I still remain very skeptical, I think some of these Haley voters, these like well-educated people that don't like candidates, would be appealing. But the problem with No Labels is that the energy seems to be on the flanks of both parties right now, and that's, I think, in some ways, just as dangerous, you know, if not more. I mean, Cornel West, if he gets on the ballot in Michigan, you know, that's like a huge risk, because he has really set out and made a very clear case against Biden's policy in Israel-Palestine. Now, for No Labels, their other big problem beyond just like, you know, getting mass appeal, and I don't know which state they would win, if any, is they can't find a candidate. They have auditioned, they have reached out to many, many, many candidates. Some have gone further along the process, and they can't find anybody. I still remain skeptical that they will field a significant ticket, but we'll see.
They've also got a big money problem. Not that they don't have any. They have a ton of money, but they can't transfer it because of the way they raised it and the vehicle they raised it into. So it's not like even if they found a candidate tomorrow, they stood up a candidate committee, they can't like pour a bunch of money into that candidate's campaign because of, you know, rules. They have to find somebody who can self-finance at least enough, and it would take quite a bit to reach that benchmark, to just get a bare bones campaign off the ground, and then they could come in with that money on, you know, in a super PAC and do a little more heavy lifting. But they have to find somebody who's at least like self-fundable enough, and that just further reduces the options. Liam, do you have any other thoughts here? I'm just wondering if I'm missing something, or if you're hearing anything I'm not on No Labels.
On No Labels, I mean. I haven't. I mean, if you think about who the people who would potentially be in the mix are sort of been taken off the board one way or another. I mean, Romney's bowed out, Manchin's bowed out. Sinema said she's not interested. Larry Hogan, who seemed to be the most person who is, you know, most captivated by that sort of attention, has found it by running for Senate. So it's just not clear who you'd go with. Other than, I mean, you need someone with credibility, name ID, and to your point, the ability to raise funds. And it just doesn't seem like there's anybody tailor-made to fit all those all those criteria.
Yeah, which this is very going to be interesting to watch. Well, I think we will know sometime next week, at least. Well, we know they canceled their convention. We'll know sometime next week what their new process is going to be. Now that we are up to speed on some of the big stories this week, this was a big news week. So it feels like we're just not going to be able to get to much of it. But what else are you paying attention to that listeners need to know about? Liam?
So the one thing I wanted to flag is something that it's just started to percolate among people who pay attention to such things, but the Corporate Transparency Act was passed a couple years ago as part of the National Defense Authorization Bill, and implementation has just waited and waited. And it's kind of like some of the Obamacare era items where the things snuck up on people, and there's sort of a late panic of how these reporting requirements are going to work. Essentially, this is ostensibly to fight money laundering and terrorism and things of that nature that can be hid behind corporate veils of various sorts. And so it's know your customer requirements from banks. This is now pushed onto individual entities who now need to report the names and identities of their owners. And it's only for smaller businesses. So in theory, this is meant to go after bad actors, but you're catching everyone, anybody who has their LLC. Ron, you're probably going to, you don't know this yet, but you're going to have to file with FinCEN. It's something that people haven't really figured out yet, but it's happening. It's going into effect this year. That was just found in a district court in Alabama to be unconstitutional. It's currently only been enjoined for the plaintiff. So FinCEN has said, we're not going to enforce this just for this small group of people who belong to the National Small Business Association before March 30th. So this is something that's going to elevate up the federal courts. I think it'll ultimately land in the Supreme Court. But it is a huge thing for small businesses that nobody has thought about. The law firms are I think licking their chops because there's going to be so much sort out here. But for right now, the first court battle has come down in a way that should make small business happy, but it raises as many questions as it does answers.
It's always the lawyers that win, isn't it? Sorry. It's true.
That's the real swamp.
It's the real swamp. Oh, man. Alex, what'd you bring?
So I'm cheating by doing two things, but they're interrelated. One is that the GOP impeachment effort is in real danger, or it is like really on the precipice of completely collapsing. At the moment, it does not appear they have the votes to go forward. They're star witnesses of the president's brother, Jim Biden, and the president's son, Hunter, did not produce these blockbuster revelations and confessions or, you know, potential perjury thing, you know, examples that, you know, James Comer had been on Newsmax, you know, every day predicting. You're seeing them already start to suggest maybe it'll just do criminal referrals to DOJ, which would be sort of a way of like an off-ramp. But as the impeachment inquiry is dying, the Republicans in some ways feel blessed with this Robert Hur report. Robert Hur is going to testify before Congress next week. The White House clearly has questioned or tried to undermine many parts of the report, and it will be fascinating to see how he answers it. But beyond Robert Hur's testimony, the really interesting thing I'm going to be watching, because it's going to be drip, 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 is all of the materials from the Hur report, especially the transcript of the president's interview, but the transcripts of a lot of these interviews. Robert Hur interviewed a ton of people, and I can tell you, you know, a lot of people he interviewed are really within the core inner circle of Biden world. And I think the revelation of some of these materials, I can tell you there is anxiety about it affecting sort of the internal dynamics, the internal politics, the internal sort of trust among the White House, because clearly, you know, with the special counsel, I think there might have been, there's a suspicion there was some, you know, covering your ass at play. And so it's just going to be fascinating as Republicans really try, as they leave impeachment, they might leave impeachment behind, they embrace this new investigation and see what sort of drip, drip comes out of it.
Let me ask you a follow-up there. Do you think his performance last night, Biden's performance last night, is going to impact the way Democrats on the committee question her? Is that going to help him somewhat, help them run cover for him?
100%. I mean, and I think the Democrats are going to really like lay into him for this. But that's, I think that's also why the transcript, and also remember the interview with Biden was also recorded too. So there's also going to be pressure to even release that audio. And then, you know, so it is a delicate game. If you go too hard at him, they'll be like, okay, we'll release the audio and we'll see if it was wrong. You know, the one thing I will say, is that basically since August 2021, which was like during Afghanistan, like in my opinion, Biden has really only done one really thorough, lengthy, tough interview. And it was with Robert Hur. So, and it's sort of just, I think the whole jousting over this interview is going to be a little bit fascinating to watch.
What's the timeline on that you expect?
So they're going through a security review right now. And so some parts of it at the very least would be, are going to be cut out for security reasons, and then beyond that, you know, that we'll see. I mean, the Congress is definitely going to subpoena it. I think it's very, everything I have heard from, you know, the swampy lawyers suggests that it definitely will come out. It's just sort of a question of when and how much of it.
They're going to claim privilege, though, on that. FBI is going to try and say you can't have this, and then you got to fight between Congress and the Justice Department, right?
Absolutely. So it's going to be messy.
Yeah, that's not good, because you don't want to look like you're hiding things. Okay, I got a thing, which this actually, we need to do a whole show on this, and I'm working on it, but I want to do it with a very smart lawyer. But you know, this is a story I've been watching since last summer. We've talked about it regularly since then. The argument that Donald Trump should be banned from federal office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I was initially very skeptical of the argument itself, but then I I subjected myself to dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of very nerdy material, very wonky papers, and I was convinced of how sound the argument was that William Bode and Michael Stokes Paulson initially laid out in their paper. And they made an originalist, textualist argument, hoping that the High Court would honor that. The High Court, which claims to be originalist and textualist, would uphold those principles. But on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled the Colorado decision, barring Trump from their primary ballot. My good friend George Conway wrote in The Atlantic that the case wasn't decided on the merits. George wrote that what the court did, and I'm quoting him, was make up a holding utterly unmoored from the text or history of the provision it was interpreting. So they ruled 9-0 that states have no power to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency. But the 14th Amendment does not say that. They also ruled 5-4, essentially, that Congress would need to vote to actively enforce Section 3 and lay out criteria for who is disqualified. George wrote, I think, pretty persuasively about the lack of logic in the opinion and the concurrences in this case, and that this case was decided this way because the justices were afraid to do what the Constitution should have required them to do. So the thing to really watch here is the hot potato, which has now been tossed to Congress, because this ruling means that Congress alone will be able to determine whether Trump is eligible for another term in office. After the SCOTUS ruling, Axios reported that Jamie Raskin is working on legislation in response. Raskin did say he doesn't expect the bill to get very far or even to the floor under Mike Johnson. So what this means is, and there's a lot of ambiguity here, because the opinion is so unclear, and lots of lawyers have lots of different views on it. But if Donald Trump wins the election in November, we could see Democrats in Congress challenge the Electoral College votes under Section 3 on January 6, 2025. That remains a very, very spooky possibility. So, do you guys have any thoughts on this before we move on to Plus?
I think the 9-0 decision to me is pretty remarkable. Just in this environment, there aren't too many things that get 9-0. And as you said, I think there's nuance to this because the secondary questions and second order questions are much more divided. But you know the potato is hot when the liberal wing of the court also agrees we don't want to touch this. This is not appropriate. This would be have pretty profound ripple effects on our system and in our society. So that to me speaks volumes, just the fact that the court unanimously says, yeah, no, this isn't going to fly.
Okay, where can everybody find you on the internet before we head over to Politicology Plus and talk about Katie Porter? Alex?
On X, I'm at Alex Thomp, so A-L-E-X-T-H-O-M-P.
Liam?
I am off X through the end of the month, but you can usually find me there at LP Donovan, and I've been writing a little bit more on my Substack at lpdonovan.substack.com. You mentioned the Lobby Shop. Check it out. We have a new episode coming out today.
Are you doing a Twitter cleanse, some kind of detox?
I've done it almost a decade now. I give it up for Lent. And it's like, it's my biggest vice. So might as well, it's a good detox. Good for my marriage, if nothing else. So
good for you. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.